The information in this podcast is provided for education and research information only. It is not a substitute for professional health advice.
If you're trying to get pregnant, or you are pregnant, and you feel a little bit overwhelmed by all you need to know, then this is the right podcast for you. Welcome to the show. I'm Bridget Maloney.
And I'm obstetrician Dr. Patrick Maloney, and this is The Kick, your expert-led podcast that delivers the essentials of growing a baby. Make sure you head to our website, growmybaby.com.au, to get some awesome free tools like our Pregnancy Knowledge Checker to help you feel like you got this.
Well, welcome everyone. I'm Bridget Maloney.
And I'm obstetrician Dr. Patrick Maloney.
And today we've got a guest, Pat, haven't we?
Yes, this is terrific. I'm excited because we're talking about something a little different for us, which is the male side of reproduction.
Yeah, I can't believe that we've taken this long to talk about 50% of the equation. But so we've invited Associate Professor Mr. Darren Katz on today. Now, he is a world-renowned urologist and a medical director of Men's Health Melbourne. Darren is heavily involved in research and he mentors urology fellows throughout the world. We're going to be talking to him about the basics, really, of male fertility and then scaffold it so we get to perhaps the what to do with male infertility if we get the time. Like, it might have to be a two-parter.
But we'll see. Be a two-parter. Yeah. That's fine.
We'll see what we get through. So welcome, Darren.
Look, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. As you know, male fertility is what I live and breathe. A lot of my time, my career is all about sort of promotion of men's health and male fertility. And I'm also a little bit surprised, to be honest, that it's taken, you know, 3 years of podcasting to sort of have someone like me on to discuss what is in 50% of the population the problem, i.e. a male factor.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you have, and we're going to move forward from here.
Only upwards now.
upwards, correct, but fantastic, and I really appreciate it, and you guys are doing a great job with your podcast. So hit me with the first question.
All right. Well, what do you think? We'll start at the basics. So if you can talk to us about what a healthy sperm looks like or is.
Okay, perfect. So let's even step back one bit. When patients come in to see me, they often say to me, "Doc, I had no idea that I had a problem down there," or "I was shooting blanks," because they ejaculate, they see an ejaculate, they see fluid come out, and they think everything's fine.
Yep.
Okay. But what's really critical our patients need to understand is that sperm is within the semen, which is the ejaculate fluid, and it makes up about 3-5% of the actual fluid. Okay. So when you actually ejaculate, whether you've got a little bit of sperm, no sperm, or a lot of sperm, in fact, it makes very little difference to the actual volume. So just because a man is able to ejaculate fluid, it doesn't mean that they've got good sperm. So that's very important, because I have a lot of patients being delayed in their diagnosis because they just said, "Well, I was ejaculating. I just thought everything was fine." So important. That's step one. Okay. And it's an important take-home message for your patients. Let's talk about a semen analysis, because that's essentially what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
And this is basically how we normally tell if a patient or can guide a patient whether or not they have a good fertility potential, which is the term that I use. And that's based on several things. But ultimately, what we use is a semen analysis. And so that's made up of different components. I've just talked about volume, but that's a small component. The three things that we talk about is how many sperm, that's concentration, how they move, and what they look like under a standard microscope. And the goal of the sperm, let's say, is to be fertile, you need to have enough sperm that are moving forward, that are able to penetrate an egg. And generally, the concentration, how many sperm, the motility, how they swim, and their morphology, what they look like under the microscope, generally that gives you an idea as to how good the sperm, how likely the sperm is to potentially sort of work and to penetrate an egg. In terms of numbers, we can go through numbers if you like.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, so the WHO, the World Health Organization, do give figures, and they update them every so often. And the latest sort of WHO analysis suggests that in men who want to have to be considered, let's say, normal, and we'll discuss what that means in terms of concentration, it needs to be approximately 15 million per mil. Okay, that's not the overall. Okay, that's 15 million per mil. So that could mean if a man usually ejaculates, let's say, at least 1.5 to 2 mils, up to 5 mils, you times 15 or whatever the number is by that mil to get the overall number. But sometimes that can be a little bit confusing. Someone might see 15 million, but in fact, they've only got 5 million concentration times 3 mil, which is 15 mil, but it still might be considered subfertile. Okay, that's important part of the equation. Motility, every lab is a bit different for motility, okay? But anywhere 30, 40% we call progressive motility, but that's a little bit different. So that's lab specific. What's important is that when patients go and have a semen analysis, they look specifically at the motility for that lab. And different labs have got different values. And I'll be honest, some labs are better than others at doing it. Motility, I believe, is best assessed when the semen is assessed, or the sperm being looked at in the semen within an hour of being ejaculated. That's another key point here. And morphology needs a little bit of unpacking. Morphology is what the actual sperm looks like under like a standard type microscope. Now, the truth is morphology, what's considered normal is actually only, let's say, 4% or more. Okay, so that means in a normal male, who has normal fertility potential, everything else being normal, the concentration, the volume, all that stuff, 96% are abnormal or less, but 96. So if they've got 4%, 5% normal morphology, that's actually what the WHO considers as normal. So that's, again, people come in and they say, "Doc, look, you know, 90% of my sperm is bad. I must be a problem." Actually, that's actually very normal if you've got 10% normal morphology. Again, so that's a bit of the explanation that needs to happen with patients. There are other aspects of the semen analysis, such as pH, which is the acidity again, but that's really refinements. But if patients want to take home the key bits of information, which is concentration, how they're swimming, i.e. their motility, and the morphology, what they look like, if they're all normal, they're on a good start.
Darren, I've always wondered about that morphology thing. If such a small number are supposed to be, or if it's normal for such a small number of them to have a normal shape, how did that come about? That seems unusual. For that sort of redundancy seems a bit unusual.
Well, if you think about evolution or whatever you like, I mean, you need a redundancy in the system. I mean, if you needed, you know, 96% normal to conceive, we wouldn't be here.
Okay. Yeah.
So you actually need a huge, we're talking about millions and millions. I mean, what does it take to make, you know, to conceive? You need one good sperm and one good egg. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And we're talking about if you've got millions that are still good, but you might even have, you know, 1 or 2 million, that's generally considered subfertile. So there does need to be quite a lot of redundancy in the system. Also, what's important here, and this means that sperm are very fragile creatures, okay? Doesn't take much for them to become a little bit, you know, not such good swimmers, or the count, or the morphology. What does that mean? So if a patient comes to see me, okay, and they've got an abnormal semen analysis, firstly, as you know, and that's another question that we can go through if you like, about how long should someone wait, but generally we're talking about the standardized guidelines is you've got to wait in at least 2 days, 2 to 3 days, but no longer than 7 days. And we can talk about whether or not that's an important sort of thing to do. But if patients come to see me and they've got this abnormal morphology, or they've been sick, whatever it is, if they've been sick, I say, well, have you been unwell? Or,
yeah,
I had a really bad cold, a really bad flu. And really, I mean, sperm can be affected by that. So if in the interleading sort of 2 or 3 months, and that's sort of the life cycle of for the sperm, it takes 2 to 3 months to see if anything in that interim period can affect the sperm. And we'll talk about how that can work in your favor as well. But if they've been unwell, say, well, let's wait a couple of months and let's redo the semen test and let's see. And that's another important bit of information for your patients. Don't do anything on one sperm test. You always need a confirmatory test. I never take one sperm test in isolation. Yes, it might give an indication. It's unlikely someone's going to go from absolutely nothing to perfect, but you still always need some confirmation. So I generally do that in almost every patient that comes to me with an abnormal semen analysis. If they had it done at a lab that I was not a typical sort of, let's say, andrology lab or a lab that does this a lot, I would get them through that at a specialized lab, maybe looking at some other things. So you do need to have a confirmatory semen analysis based on one.
Good. And do you wait 2 to 3 months for that, if that's the life cycle of the sperm?
It depends on if they have had something wrong in the interim.
Mm.
Okay, so if they've been sick or unwell, yes, I would wait. But if they have, if they've been completely well, doc, nothing, you can certainly wait less than that. I wouldn't do it the next week, but you need to wait, 4 to 6 weeks, I'd say. Correct. That's what I would do.
I really want to go back to the WHO, because you say they're new guidelines. Is the new guidelines, like, you hear it in the media, don't you, that our sperm aren't...
It's getting worse.
Yeah, aren't as good
getting
as they
worse,
were.
Yeah.
Is that reflected in the WHO new guidelines?
It is. They have, and there's lots of talk as to why that happens. Is it the environment? We're getting a bit, the community, as in like the whole sort of world population in the Western society, is getting more obese, more unhealthy. Is it all the... things that we're eating, the fast food, the phthalates in our drink bottles, we don't know. Although, the fertility rate is still reasonable, but there's all fertility rate, as you know, there are choices behind why patients, why people these days might have less children than others. It's a whole lot of issues, but
yeah.
It is decreasing, and I don't think the exact reasons why this is occurring has been sort of definitively said, but yes, the numbers are coming down. Correct.
Wow. And this is a bit of a fascinoma. It won't help patients at all, but when you talk about motility, how does a sperm swim? Is it just in a straight line, or is it, like someone who's drunk?
This is actually newish information which has come out the last few years. So classically, we think of sperm as sort of squealing along like a snake. But in fact, the sperm actually does a bit of a corkscrew effect. Oh. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So if you look at this under 3D, it's been sort of determined that it actually, and which makes sense, because if you want to sort of penetrate something like a corkscrew, right, you actually want to do that. So it actually, the tail actually does sort of like that. Yeah, so that's how it swims.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is a question for you, Pat. So I would imagine that the first port of call is either their GP or maybe they're already at a gynecologist.
Yeah.
Who, when you see someone that you think it's male factor in the fertility issue,
yeah,
when do you start investigating, and how do you do that? Like, what would a patient expect?
Yeah, I think it's good practice. So when I see a woman who's been referred to me with a subfertility, I think it's very good practice to consider male factor from the very beginning, and to take a brief and targeted history from the partner. Have they had any children from a previous relationship? Have they ever had genital surgery, infections, varicose veins in their scrotum, those sort of things? And then moving towards getting a semen analysis done relatively early in the piece, because even if you strongly suspect, say, for example, endometriosis or blocked tubes as being behind the issue in the woman, it's very interesting how often both people in the couple have a fertility issue contributing when you multiply one person's slight subfertility by the other person's slight subfertility, how that couple goes on to have an actual clinical problem. Mm. So, yeah, we ask up front. I wonder what Darren thinks about that, because it's really interesting for me, seeing mostly women. We'll get to the point where I'm proposing laparoscopic surgery and tubal dye studies and excision of endometriosis, and often the woman is very invested in the outcome by this stage, and she'll be saying, yep, sign me up, doc, whatever. But occasionally we get some resistance from men to having a semen analysis done out of enormous fear of what the result might show.
I'm so glad you're bringing this up. Honestly, it is so critically important. We don't have Australian guidelines, and a bit of a spoiler alert, within the next year or two, we will be having Australian guidelines. I'm on the guidelines panel for guidelines for all medical practitioners in Australia and New Zealand for male infertility management. Okay. Part of those guidelines, one of the action points, one of the guidelines, will be that men and women need to be assessed simultaneously.
Yeah, brilliant.
Okay. That's going to be in the guidelines. And in fact, all worldwide guidelines in Europe, in America, all state that as well. But I can't tell you how many patients I've lost count where the woman, unfortunately, is the one who's blamed for being infertile. She's gone through a whole ringer of tests.
Yeah.
She's gone, is it laparoscope, whatever you want, test, Schubel, patency, bloods, whatever, whatever, whatever. And it's months down the track. And someone says, well, maybe we should look at, you know, Joe Blow here.
Yeah. Right?
But he thinks he's normal because he looks normal. And as I mentioned before, there's semen coming out when he ejaculates. And lo and behold, he's the problem. Okay. And so I'm so glad that your practice is to simultaneously assess both male and female because, as you mentioned in your introduction, 50% of the time, the male is either the sole cause or a contributor to a couple's infertility. So why would you ignore exactly 50% of the problem?
Yeah.
So it's critical. And it doesn't take much. A semen test is great. You know, maybe just some standard hormonal blood tests as well. And if they're all good, good to go. If you're not, then that couple needs to have further investigation.
All right. So I'm just trying to get the life cycle of this. So the couple have then done both tests, and the males come back with a poor semen analysis. Then what do you do as an obstetrician, Pat?
You're listening to The Kick with Dr. Pat and Bridget.
Hi, everyone. Well, we've got a milestone coming up and we want to celebrate it with you, our listeners. May 7th, we're going to launch our 100th episode of The Kick. And guess what? We couldn't have done it without our listeners. To celebrate, we are asking for you to tell us your biggest tips about getting pregnant, being pregnant, becoming a mother, birth, anything that you think future listeners might benefit from. And we want 100 voices. As a gift to you for adding your voice, we will give everyone a whopping 50% discount to any of our programs. You can use this yourself or gift it to a friend. To add your voice, go to our website, growmybaby.com.au. We will then put a selection of the voices together for our 100th episode. That sounds like fun, doesn't it? So the website again is growmybaby.com.au. We are so excited to hear all your biggest tips for future mamas just like you.
Yeah, well, I think this is really interesting because there are some results that are a kind of a bigger problem than others. So if there's no sperm at all, for example, not only do we have a reproductive problem, but it might hint at a serious health problem for the male if there's no sperm at all. And sometimes that, you know, that definitely requires an expert analysis of that. By a urologist or a general physician or a geneticist, yeah. So we need to, you know, be careful when we're doing a semen analysis because we might uncover a big issue, yeah. And then if it's lower amounts, then we have to think: is this something that can be corrected by lifestyle, or does this need expert intervention at the andrology end, the male reproductive end? So small deficits, you might be able to say to that guy, well, you got to stop smoking and drink less and recover from the flu you've got at the moment and we'll retest you. But bigger, more significant defects, we need Darren.
And I'm confused between urology help at this moment and an endocrinologist for the andrology test. Like what's the difference there? What's the first specialist people say?
It's all dependent on, as we are urologists, there aren't many of us that specialize in male fertility, even in Australia, New Zealand. I mean, in fact, in New Zealand, there was basically nobody really that's done a subspecialty fellowship. And each year I get a urologist from overseas to train with me for a year in all these different sort of aspects. Usually they're from America, but we realized that New Zealand had basically no one. So we just finished training a New Zealand urologist who is very good. He's gone back there. So there's not many of us that train in this area, but we're classically surgeons. But in this area of andrology, we urologists who do this do a lot of the andrology, but the andrology just means sort of the medical side of things, if you know what I mean. So if you go and have a heart problem, okay, you can see a cardiologist who can do certain things, although cardiologists are interventionalists. That's maybe not the best analogy, but if you need to have big surgery, you're going to see a heart surgeon, okay? Yeah. If you have a problem with something in your brain that might need some medication, you can see a neurologist, okay, a brain physician. But if you got a brain tumor, you need operation, you can then go see a neurosurgeon who probably does also know quite a bit about what the neurologist does. So, I mean, if you come and see someone like me with these problems, we generally manage most things. I do a lot of hormonal manipulation, hormonal assessment, genetic assessments. If it gets to a point where I realize this is mainly a hormonal issue, I then have got my, as you say, andrologist that I refer to for those reasons. Let's say, as an example, in the pituitary gland, which is a gland in the brain, which can regulate some of the hormones to help make. So if there's a problem there, that's not something that I can help with, but an endocrinologist, especially an andrologist, specialized in that can help in that respect. So we often work hand in hand, and some patients, as you say, like Pat, like you might send a patient who's got a big sperm issue to one of your local, let's say, endocrinologists or hormone doctors who have an interest in this, and they might say, actually, I think it's time for Darren to see what he can do. You know, they might diagnose a big varicocele, we can talk about that in a second. They might diagnose a different type of hormonal problem. They might diagnose for which they can't help, but they need surgery, whatever it is. So we often do work together. And in this field, perhaps more than almost any field, it's almost mandated that you need sort of a what we call a multidisciplinary approach, because, you know, you've got female issues, you've got male issues, you have all my, and so often you need a whole team together who experience to get the best outcome for the patient. But Pat, I'll just touch on one thing that you said beforehand, you know, depending on where you refer to, depending on sort of the degree or the magnitude of the deficit or the issue with the sperm count. My feeling is that if a patient has an abnormal sperm count, and we can talk about what that means, but if it's, you know, if it's getting down to single digit type of concentrations, et cetera, or, you know, terrible morphology or bad swimmers, then they probably do need the next level assessment by an andrologist or a specialist urologist in that area. Because as much as my IVF colleagues hate for me to say this, right, my goal when I see a patient is for them to avoid IVF.
Yeah.
Okay. So my goal is to optimize a patient to get them to the next rung in the ladder, okay? So if they've got, let's say, worst of the worst, right, is no sperm, okay, and this is quite a large part of my practice, unfortunately, because of a production problem, my goal is, well, can I get some sperm somehow to allow them to do IVF rather than rely on donor or adoption or fostering, okay? So they can actually be a biological parent. So that's that, right? Or if they come to me, they've got very little sperm and, you know, they're saying that they need, you know, let's say IVF or ICSI or whatever it is, okay, well, can I improve, even if they can do IUI, which is intrauterine insemination, which, as you know, is a gentler form of IVF that some patients need, or if they're at the point where they're at IUI, can I improve things that I can see naturally? So that's my goal for patients. And I mean, it doesn't always work out, but if I can help them to at least get to that next level, everyone's better for it, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
So I wouldn't always just say if, you know, if it's very severe that you need a specialist, I think even mild cases might benefit. There are also, again, in these guidelines that we're talking about, which will be, like I said, released in a year or two, there is a suggestion in one of the guidelines that with abnormal semen analysis that are being confirmed, that probably does need a referral by someone that's got a subspecialty training in this area. It doesn't have to be a urologist per se, or an endocrinologist, could be an IVF doctor that's also got, whatever it is, it needs to have someone that is able to assess appropriately and manage as well.
Excellent.
All right. Can we talk about when then someone comes with a, you said mild sperm analysis, and we kind of haven't talked about what the numbers of that might look like. So maybe we'll start there. And then if you could share how you get that person on the next rung so their fertility is improved.
So that's, I mean, the second part of the question is going to be very difficult because the causes, we can talk about for 20 minutes, but the causes of mild sperm problems. But let's talk about some numbers. We talked about 15 million being normal, for instance. Okay, that's what's called the fifth centile, okay, according to WHO. That means 95% of patients who are considered fertile have a count of 15 million or more. Okay.
Yeah.
That still means that 5% of patients can still be less than 15 million and be considered completely fertile. Okay. So it's just what's called the fifth centile. But even when you get down to call less than 5 million or 1 to 5 million, about 20 or 30% can still conceive naturally over the next 2 or 3 years. But of course, that's assuming completely normal partner. Okay. And we can't, just like when someone comes and sees Pat, he doesn't want to ignore the male. When a patient sees me, I don't ignore the female either. Yeah. I've got to see, you know, where she's at, what's her age, what's her fertility potential, where's her AMH at, all these, you know, other comorbidities, you know, has she been assessed by an IVF doctor? Because that all comes into the equation as to, you know, where to next. Because I can do whatever you like to try and improve a man's fertility potential, but if in the end this patient can only conceive through IVF and it's been determined, you know, there's no point beating around the bush trying to get them from whatever, you know, 2 million to 5 million or 5 million. There's no point doing that, okay, if they just need to hurry. And especially as we can appreciate throughout sort of the generations, there's an advanced maternal age and people are having their first child, and there is a biological clock, so to speak, which actually also occurs in the male, but not to the same degree. And so if female a partner is, you know, in their late 30s or early 40s, you know, you don't want to spend several months trying to sort things out when they just need to crack on. So that also comes into the equation. But there are certain, we talk about lifestyle issues, which you really need to assess. And when a patient comes to see me, we talk about these in detail. I've got a handout that we've got. This is something that patients often get see here. But you know, it goes through talking about what a balanced diet is, what the diet should be, why we recommend it. We talk about antioxidants. We talk about supplements in the handout. We talk about, you know, weight. We talk about smoking, alcohol, binge drinking, exercise, heat, caffeine, stress. You know, these things do make a difference. But they're not going to make it. I believe that these things do make a small difference. Okay, we're talking about if someone's got a mild problem.
Yeah.
Okay, then I think they do make a difference, and they can actually get patients over the line to avoid IVF. In some cases, assuming there's no other major issue with the female. But if a patient's, you know, got terrible sperm,
yeah,
and you know, it's unlikely there's something else going on besides that. Okay. There is something. It doesn't mean you should do these things because, you know, every little 1% might make the difference, okay? But these are things that we go through with patients, and most patients actually try and do these anyway. Also from a place called Healthy Male, we often give these little handout. Yeah, as you can see, this is, from the Healthy Male. It's a great little thing. Patients can get this, or they can download it from the internet. It's free. Again, it just talks about how to look after your sperm. And if you are going to go, let's say the woman is young enough that you can afford to try these things and you can afford to redo the semen analysis and see if there's been any change, whether you're doing supplements or something obvious to stop smoking, the life cycle of a sperm is about 3 months, call it. Just, that's a very sort of conservative but a safe thing. So there's no point instituting something and then 2 weeks later checking and seeing if it's worked. You actually got to wait for the sperm to react to whatever change you've made. Give it time and check it again in 3 or 4 months and see if there's been any change.
That's great.
It's really important about it. People check too, nothing's helped. So there's no point me doing this, but they've only checked it, you know, 3 weeks later. It's not going to change.
Darren, I know that we've hit the half hour mark, and before we started started that podcast, this podcast, Darren said he's got to go and see patients, and Pat has actually got someone in labour as we're recording, so we might have to wrap it up soon.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack here, though.
Yeah, I know.
And this depth that we go into is because our listeners are often people who are looking for more than you could give on a 15-second grab on the news. They're people who want to hear it in this sort of detail. And I think that's because they're really motivated people, but often people find human reproduction just interesting, even if they're not even in our fields. When I send a couple off for IVF and there's a diagnosed male factor, one of the first tests I sometimes get back is a test for a thing called a Y micro deletion. And I'm just wondering what that is. There's some sort of problem with the Y chromosome that sort of codes for healthy sperm production.
I'm very happy to answer that. I know a lot about this, but that is a very sort of rarish type of...
Is it? Okay.
So basically, just for your listeners, there are two sex chromosomes. There's an X and an X on a female and an X and a Y on a male. So male is the only, we're talking about cis male, has got a Y chromosome, and in that codes for the genes, and one of the genes, etc., includes making sperm. Okay, so if there's a problem with a part of that gene, there can be a problem with making sperm. And we're talking about, usually it's about one in, I think, 2,000 or 3,000.
Oh, okay.
Okay, now... the indication for testing for that is different, but certainly must be less than 5 million. Okay, right. So there's no point testing for Y chromosome micro deletion if it's more than that. I also think there's a significant cost to patients for doing it as well. I don't think it's actually a bulk build as many other tests are. And the vast majority of the time it's tested for, in my experience, it's normal.
Okay.
Okay. But there are different parts of the Y chromosome that can be abnormal. Okay, it's something called sort of, let's say, the DAS gene. They're called microdeletions, and there are three different parts. There's just called A, B, and C. Usually, when it's an A or B, there's actually zero sperm. Okay, when it's C, can be zero, but often there's just could be a moderate to severe defect going on. But these are rare things. It's not something that I believe that a standard sort of panel should be testing for.
Good.
It often needs genetic counseling in association with that. And especially if it's abnormal, it needs genetic counseling, because any male that has this problem, they will pass it on to male offspring.
Yes.
100%.
Yes.
Right. But again, this is rare stuff. So I appreciate why it was a burning question, because it's not well discussed. Because also it's not very common, so it's not something that people deal with a lot.
Good.
What I think people will listen to this that perhaps are just starting to think about pregnancy, and they'll send it off to their partners. And we've talked about a lot of abnormal. But can we talk, just before we say goodbye, can we talk about like three top tips that you've got, or more, to have a healthy male have healthy sperm?
Perfect. Okay, look, there's lots of things we can say on that, but let's talk about the basics, about, let's say, fertile window. I mean, Pat, you know more about this than anyone, right? But there's only a period of time in a female cycle that they are fertile, that they can generally talk about it 6 days, 5 days, 7 days, whatever. Everyone's a little bit different, okay? So what I tell patients is, if they say to me, what's the best chance to maximize our chances of conception? I say, well, firstly, you narrow the basics. Your partner needs to go to the chemist, get a kit,
know when a
fertile window is, point one. Point two is you need to have regular intercourse around that time frame. Okay, now, I don't tell patients to do it every day, because that just stresses people out and it's too hard. So I just say, you know, at least every second day around that period. Sperm can actually last for about 3 days in the sort of vaginal mucus, so to speak, and internally. So, but every second day is probably is enough.
Yeah.
The other thing which is important, it's quite common for couples to use lubricants. And most lubricants you buy on the market are actually spermicidal. So if one of the first things I ask the couple is, are you using lubricants? And not infrequently the answer will be yes. I say, well, just go and source the different ones on the market, specifically ones that are favorable for sperm. Okay. Because most of the other ones you buy, KY, whatever, are actually spermicidal. And that could just be the difference. They're not doing it at the right time. They're using, you know, spermicidal lubricants, and it's a problem. Then obviously we look at their lifestyle. And we see where things that are, all those things we talked about are important. I encourage men to actually know what's going on. A lot of women, they'll go to their GP or obstetrician, they'll get the test done, the blood test, the ultrasound, or whatever. But men are getting nothing, right? Mm-hmm. So I say, get your semen analysis, get some blood tests, your something called an FSH, your LH, your testosterone level, and work out where you're at, right? You know. And so we've got some facts and figures to work with. That, I think, is the best bit of information your patients can have. Know when to do it, try and be healthy, and know where they're standing from a factual standpoint. Get some blood tests and a semen test. And that's a great start point, and probably a good way to end the discussion.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's terrific practical advice.
I'm also really surprised. Men have FSH and LH as well, do they?
Correct. Yeah. Correct.
See,
correct.
I didn't know correct. That.
There you go.
Correct, and that's a whole other sort of important part of the discussion we can have at the part two.
Yeah, we'll talk about hormones then. All right. So, Darren, thank you so much for that. I know that everybody's got to go, but wow, I have got lots of questions. I'm going to write them down. And if you're ready and got some more availability, we might have you back, and we'll talk about other things.
That's been an absolute pleasure, and thank you so much for your podcast and all your good work.
What a great conversation, Pat.
That was really good. And I, like all good conversations, it's raised more questions.
Oh, no.
But we'll be back. That's good.
Yeah. Everyone, don't panic. Send us your questions. If you've got more questions you want us to ask Darren next time, send it in via DM, either on Instagram, I think it's probably the best, the Kick Pregnancy Podcast, and just DM us there. Now, Darren mentioned a couple of acronyms, but we were in a bit of a rush. I didn't pull him up and say, hey, what does that mean? But Pat, could you just tell people what the acronyms FSH mean?
Oh, sure. Yeah, he mentioned FSH and LH, which are the same hormones that women have got.
Yeah, so, I was really surprised by that.
Yeah, so FSH is the hormone that comes out of your brain in women. It's follicle stimulating hormone, so it tells the ovary to start making a follicle, which is the little sac on the ovary that the egg's going to come out of. And LH is luteinizing hormone, and that's the hormone that's going to tell the ovary to get that egg ready for production.
So what does it do in a male then?
It tells the testes to make sperm.
Oh, okay, good.
And testosterone.
Oh, so you need that to produce testosterone.
Yeah, so that's its end product in the male is testosterone and sperms. And in women, it's to make eggs.
All right.
Yeah.
So he also mentioned when a woman needs to get all the tests, and he mentioned the acronym AMH.
Yes, when he was talking about that battery of tests that a woman might go through, AMH is anti-Müllerian hormone, and it's a measure in women of, let's say, reproductive capacity or ovarian reserve.
Good. Yeah?
Typically used in someone who's, who's perhaps got age-related infertility, where we can use that to sort of say, look, you might be 38, but you've got a 30-year-old's fertility, ovarian reserve, or you're 38, but you're more like a 42-year-old in terms of ovarian reserve.
And we also talked about some lifestyle factors, and Darren was holding up a pamphlet. We're going to find the connection from that. It's just healthymale.org.au.
But healthymale.org.au.
Good. I'll put that in the show notes, the link in the show notes. Perfect. As well. Good. Well, I hope that helps everybody. Pat, you've got to go off and
waiting for this baby to come.
Have a baby. So we'll and this weekend we've got our niece's wedding. It's very exciting. So that's my joy this weekend. All right.
Excellent.
Have a good weekend, everybody, and we will see you next week.
Thanks for listening.
Bye for now.